Welcome back for Hour 3 of Issues Etc. Let me take this time to remind you that tomorrow during this time slot, you're going to be hearing Share-a-thon 2003 all day, in fact. Thursday, Friday, Saturday is AM 850 KFUO Share-a-thon 2003. We'll be asking for you to support the gospel outreach of AM 850 KFUO with your gifts, your generous gifts, your frequent gifts. That's what we're really here for. I mean, on those 3 days, we are here to ask you as our listeners, because we're entirely listener-supported, to support the gospel outreach of AM 850 KFUO. Be sure to tune in and give us a call during Share-a-thon 2003 anytime in the next 3 days with your generous gift. That means this is the last live hour of Issues Etc. this week, so let's make the most of it. Wesley Smith joins us here in the first half hour to talk about a fake cloning bill that's in the U.S. Senate. It happens to be called S-303. We'll find out what it's all about, who is sponsoring it, some interesting sponsors, and what can be done to actually forestall, I think that's all we can do here, is forestall the issue of human cloning in the United States. Then in the second half hour of this last hour of the program, Dr. James Dretke, director of the Zwamer Institute for Muslim Studies, joins us to talk about the Shiite pilgrimage. There's a picture in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Over 1 million Shiites marched in pilgrimage to a shrine in Karbala, Iraq. We'll find out why. We'll find out why they were beating themselves, chanting, and cutting themselves with swords when we talk to Dr. James Dretke in the last half hour of the program. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Wesley Smith is a regular guest here on Issues Etc., senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of several books, including The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and he has written a recent column for National Review Online titled Banning It, Getting Past Hatch Feinstein. Wesley, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm very well. Tell us about S-303. It purports to ban human cloning.
Well, it's a phony ban. It's called the Human Cloning Ban and Stem Cell Research Protection Act. The only problem is that it is not a human cloning ban. It is a human cloning specific authorization. Indeed, what it authorizes if passed is a procedure in human life called SCNT, somatic nuclear cell transfer. That is the act of human cloning. What it purports to prevent is bringing a cloned human embryo to birth, but it does not prevent cloning. Indeed, it authorizes it.
All right, before we go on to sort out both the sponsors and the kind of sly technique offer being put forth here in S-303, make the distinction for us, if one exists, between what's called therapeutic or reproductive cloning. Is there a distinction?
There is no distinction in the act of cloning. The act of cloning in either case is called, as I said, somatic nuclear cell transfer. And here's how that occurs. You take a woman's egg, you take out the nucleus, you then take a nucleus from, say, a skin cell, and you put that where the woman's egg nucleus used to be. You stimulate it with electricity, and if it works, it begins to develop embryonically. That is, it is now an embryo. And the reason it can be an embryo is because the somatic cell nucleus has 46 chromosomes. At that point, the act of cloning is completed. Then it's just a matter of what you do with that life you have created through cloning, or what's called asexual reproduction. Sexual reproduction being the blending of sperm and egg, fertilization, conception, so forth. Cloning is asexual reproduction. After that, if you research on the cloned embryo, it's called therapeutic cloning or cloning for biomedical research. If you implant it in a woman and bring it to birth, it's called reproductive cloning. But actually, the act of cloning is the same in both cases.
So cloning is cloning. The only question is, what does one do with the clone, the human embryo, after cloning is complete?
Exactly right.
What reproductive cloning would allow the clone to go to full term in a mother's womb?
Correct.
What happens in so-called therapeutic cloning?
Well, supposedly what happens in therapeutic cloning is that there would be a banning of implantation, and that's supposed to prevent a human clone baby from ever being born. The only problem is, What the Hatch-Feinstein bill would actually do is authorize under law the very kind of research that remains to be done before a human baby can ever come to full term in terms of cloning. There, right now, they have not been able to create, through cloning, a human embryo blastocyst. A blastocyst is an embryo that is 1 week in development. At that point in time, it has more than 100 cells, it has a liquid center, and it has a lining, which, if implanted in the womb, develops into the placenta. They haven't been able to do that yet. Hatch-Feinstein is specifically intended to permit and to authorize and to create the social milieu wherein that kind of research can take place so that a blastocyst can be made. The reason is supposedly to get the stem cells. But if you get a human blastocyst, you can either take stem cells from it or you can implant it in a woman, because the blastocyst is the blastocyst is the blastocyst, as you pointed out. Hatch-Feinstein also would not prevent very bizarre experiments such as using animal eggs and implanting animal eggs with human DNA, the reason being to try to figure out which kind of human cell would be best to help create blastocysts for the purposes of reproduction. That would also be permitted under Hatch-Feinstein. And in fact, there's a doctor named Zavos who is intending and has very loudly declared his intention to create a cloned human baby, who has recently completed two experiments. In one, he took a cow egg and he took a human skin cell or some other kind of cell and created a early embryo with that. And he intends to keep doing that with different kinds of human cell types to see which kind would be best for use in reproductive cloning. That would be authorized under Hatch-Feinstein, the supposed law that would supposedly ban human cloning. He has also announced, this Dr. Zavos, that he has successfully created a human embryo with a human egg and cloning to the 8-cell stage. That's not the blastocyst stage, but it's the 8-cell stage, which again would be specifically authorized under the Hatch-Feinstein Act. So what Hatch-Feinstein would authorize is the very kind of procedures this doctor is doing overseas, because he's worried about the potential for outlawing it here. So he's doing it overseas. If you pass Hatch-Feinstein, he can might as well come on shore, and you might as well multiply him by 1,000, because that kind of research will receive the official imprimatur of the United States of America.
Why does Hatch-Feinstein appeal in the Senate to senators who are a little iffy on how they want to vote on other cloning bills?
Well, it's a classic twofer. In other words, they can vote for Hatch-Feinstein. They can then tell pro-life people and people who oppose cloning, hey, I voted to oppose human cloning, because that's what the title of the legislation says, right? They can then turn around and go to big biotech companies who are their campaign contributors and go to people like Christopher Reeve and say, hey, I voted to permit human cloning for biomedical research. So they can have it both ways with one vote.
What do we do with one of the first of the primary sponsors of this bill, Orrin Hatch, who up to this point, at least in the pro-life community, was considered to be more or less an ally? Why has he been brought over to the side of Hatch-Feinstein?
I'd say to the dark side.
Yeah.
Orrin Hatch is an odd duck. Now, I'm not in Washington, D.C. I don't think you could call him a pro-lifer. As I understand the pro-life philosophy, life begins at the point of conception. And I would assume that pro-lifers would say that if cloning were ever successful, life would begin at the point of what I call inception. That is, when you have started that embryonic process of human cloning through SCNT, which, by the way, is how Dolly the sheep came into being, was that kind of process. He is anti-abortion, no question. I think what has happened, and this is all supposition, I don't know his heart, I think that he has said that human life does not begin in a refrigerator, it begins in a woman's womb. Well, that turns when life begins from a matter of biology to a matter of where that life is.
Geography.
Geography, yeah. And that may have to do, I don't know, with his Mormon beliefs in terms of when the soul enters the embryo. I don't know. Perhaps, you know, he gets a lot of attention from the media when he takes a non-quote pro-life, close-quote position. He's being feted by BIO, which is the big biotechnology lobbying group. He's been named Legislator of the Year by them. And even though they would tend to oppose issues that a supposed pro-lifer would support. But he's not the only pro-lifer who has come out in favor of some of these technologies. Connie Mack did too, who used to be a senator from Florida, on the basis that one of his children has a disease that he hopes would receive some medical benefit from embryonic stem cell therapy. But that kind of feeds into I hang around both pro-lifers and pro-choicers, and I can tell you that a classic criticism of the pro-life movement is from pro-choicers is they'll say, yeah, this man's pro-life until his 14-year-old daughter gets pregnant. Well, you could say the same thing about Connie Mack. He's pro-life until he thinks that destroying another human life can help his daughter.
What other bills are under consideration to the present Senate that could be better substitutes or perhaps the best substitute for Hatch-Feinstein?
Well, there is a true cloning ban that has been put forward by Sam Brownback of Kansas and Mary Landrieu, who, by the way, is not pro-life, of Louisiana. It's called the Brownback-Landrieu bill. It's the Human Cloning Prohibition Act, accurately named. It's S-245, and it outlaws all SCNT using human life. That is the true ban on human cloning. It has already passed the House of Representatives in a strong bipartisan vote, by the way. It wasn't just Republicans and it wasn't just pro-lifers who voted for this. There were others. Democrats voted for it and pro-choicers voted for it. President Bush is eager to sign the bill, and the only holdup is in the United States Senate. I believe that Brownback has more than 50 votes after this last election, but it probably does not have 60, which, as you know, is required to end debate in the Senate and to stop a filibuster. And the reason why you don't have enough votes to stop the filibuster is Hatch-Feinstein, which doesn't really expect to pass, but is basically there to be the blocking mechanism to prevent Brownback from passing.
How well understood, at least according to your estimation, is the phony nature of Hatch-Feinstein in the Senate?
It's not well understood, and there's also a lot of cynicism because I have seen letters from people who have written to their senators saying, we want you to ban human cloning. And they'll say, oh, yes, I want to ban human cloning, but, you know, we mustn't stop medical research. I think that's showing complete disrespect to constituents. If these folk want to have human cloning for research purposes, they should admit it. I mean, there's an argument to be made on that side. I disagree with it completely. I think it turns human life into an object. The idea that we can create human life and that legally it would have to be destroyed is one of the most radical ideas that I've ever seen. The idea that human life should be harvested like it's a corn crop, to me, is a very radical idea, and especially since we can get many, if not all, of the benefits hoped for through cloning from adult stem cell research, which is already in human trials, by the way. I just find it to be utterly disingenuous. But somebody can believe that sincerely and say, listen, the potential good outweighs what might be wrong with it, and say it honestly, and at least I'll disagree with you, but I'll respect your honesty. But to say you're voting against human cloning when you're actually voting for it, and to write letters, as I've seen from many senators, saying that they're, of course they're against human cloning, but they have to support this medical research, it's just to disrespect the constituent.
We're talking about a fake cloning bill in the U.S. Senate, variously known as S-303, Hatch-Feinstein, or its official title, Human Cloning Ban and Stem Cell Research Protection Act. That's an oxymoron if there ever was one. With Wesley Smith, he has written a column for National Review Online titled, Banning It, Getting Past Hatch-Feinstein. Now, you can read this column on the Internet at Wesley's website. It's WesleyJSmith.com. All one word, WesleyJSmith.com, and some other articles he has written as well. Why is it so easy for the total ban bill to pass the House and such an obstacle in the Senate?
Because of the filibuster rule. The House, it's up or down. In the Senate, you can hold bills hostage even if you have a minority position. In the Senate, in order to stop debate, you have to get 60 votes. So that if you have 53 or 54 votes for your bill, but you don't have 60, you can't get it to the floor. And that's what's happening in this circumstance.
You mentioned also the president's stance here. Has the president explicitly expressed a desire to sign Brownback Landrieu?
Absolutely. In fact, last year, he not only expressed the desire, he held a White House event to which I was invited, but unfortunately could not attend because I was in Canada, in which he made a very big speech in the East Room and put a full-court press on to pass the Brownback bill. I hope he will do so again. Now, he's pretty busy dealing with some very urgent matters, so I don't know what his time situation is, but George Bush has been excellent on the cloning issue.
The underreported element in all of this politicking and in all of these bills, and you've noted this many times, is what you call big biotech. What is big biotech?
Big biotech is my term for the biotechnology industry, which is pouring millions of dollars into the lobbying in favor of the right to clone human life, and also the desire to get federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, which they would personally, not personally, but as companies, benefit from. What's going on here is quite often people like me who take a very strong position in on behalf of the sanctity of all human life and the idea that we don't want to turn human life into an object, we're accused of being either religiously motivated or ideologically motivated, and supposedly we are in opposition to these objective scientists and researchers who only have human welfare in mind. But the other side of this debate, if I'm ideological, and I would agree I probably am, I have important principles that I'm trying to support. But the other side is just as ideological as I am. There are many people who in research who believe that there should be nothing they can't do if they think it is scientifically justified. In fact, I submit in this debate, the question is on the table, does science serve society or does science dominate society? And that's very much at play in this debate. Also, there's a real financial conflict of interest for some of these medical researchers. You know, when Einstein was at Princeton, he didn't set up a corporation. He made a lot of money, as he should have. I mean, he was a brilliant genius, obviously, but he made his money by teaching at Princeton, by writing books, by speaking around the world, and so forth. He did not go out and start a corporation called Relativity, Inc. But today on the university campus, you'll find a lot of these biotechnology researchers who want to be able to do all of this this embryonic research and cloning and so forth. The minute they have a breakthrough, before they publish and before they tell the world, they go out and get a patent. Then they create a biotech company, and then they affiliate with a big biotech company and get a lot of money to try to take these things into the marketplace and produce products. So it seems to me that that aspect of this debate has been utterly neglected by the mainstream media. The only reporter that I know who has really farmed this vein, or mined this vein, to not mix my metaphors, is a man named a very good reporter who I don't know whether he's for or against these technologies, but his name is Neil Munro, and he writes for the National Journal. But the National Journal is mainly subscribed to by policymakers. It costs like $1,500 a year to subscribe to the publication, so it does not get wide distribution. But there is a real conflict of interest on the other side financially, as well as the ideological idea that we should have no limits on scientific research.
Someone is going to say, you make the point in the middle of your article that folks like you who say, look, if Hatch-Feinstein becomes law, this is the future that lies ahead. You say, like modern-day Cassandras, where we know the future, but we can't get anyone to believe that this is the future that is coming. You told us before about this doctor who has created what's called chimera, a cross of species. in a cloning process, make the convincing case that this is not simply Raelian kind of craziness. This is not science fiction. This is the brave new world that lies ahead if something like Hatch Feinstein becomes law.
Right. Dr. Zavos is not like Rael. Rael, in my view, who's this flying saucer cult leader, is running a huge scam, and he's making a lot of money. He's getting people, for example, parents of dead children, to pay his group hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to clone their dead children. And I was in a debate with Brigitte Bussier, that odd-looking woman who you saw on the news a few months ago, and she basically said during this debate, to which, by the way, Raelians came from all over the Southwest and the South, it was at Alabama, University of Alabama, bringing grieving parents to hear the debate, and she was pushing the idea that you can save your dead child's toys because we can clone the dead child, which I found utterly reprehensible, to take advantage of people going through perhaps the worst pain that anyone can experience. But Zavos is not of that ilk. Zavos is trying to create, to do reproductive cloning. He has some money. He's doing it overseas. He is now beginning to publish his work in scientific journals. The using the chimera embryo human cow chimera embryo he has written about. He published those in an online journal just generally, but he didn't go into the specifics. He's about to publish specifically. So he is literally going about this work. Now, right now, you do not have a lot of people trying to do this, but if you gave an explicit legalization to this effort, which would be, of course, the end of the Brownback Landrieu approach, you'd have a bunch of entrepreneurs who might venture capitalists who would open their checkbooks for cloning. Right now, they're not paying for cloning because it might be outlawed, so they're sitting on their wallets. You legalize it, and this research cloning will go forward. And you can say the research cloning is for stem cell research, which, of course, I disagree with, too, but the same research would be able to be applied to the reproductive cloning. Then you have some laws that have, not laws, but legislation introduced in New Jersey and Texas.
We've only got about 30 seconds here, Wesley.
That would literally, and we've talked about this on a previous show, I believe, allow not only implantation, but gestation through the ninth month of a cloned fetus. And that is, so there's something going on here that is way beyond stem cells, and I haven't figured out what it is. I have some ideas, but we can talk about that on a future show.
Wesley Smith, I look forward to talking to you again. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Todd.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of a great book called Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. He has also written a column for National Review Online, among many others. This one is titled, Banning It, Getting Past Hatch Feinstein. When we come back from this break, the last half hour of Issues, Etc., we will spend finding out why we witnessed last night and the last several days this 1 million man march on Karbala, Iraq, a pilgrimage of Shiite Muslims. Why did they go there, and what were they doing with all the yelling, the chanting, the stomping, the beating of themselves, and cutting themselves with swords? This is a different face of Islam than we are accustomed to seeing. We'll find out what it's all about when we come back from this break. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our guest in the next hour, Dr. James Dredke, director of the Zwamer Institute for Muslim Studies. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Before his crucifixion, why was Jesus tried before the Jewish council, the Jewish king, and the Roman governor? The story of Jesus' passion, crucifixion, and resurrection is beautifully retold and illustrated in our new Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, by Dr. Paul Meyer. You can order The Very First Easter online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on how to order this book, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you write or call, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, 1-800-325-3040. Or order the book online at issuesetc.org.
Genesis. It's mentioned throughout the Bible. Answers with Ken Ham, host of the acclaimed film, The Genesis Solution. Well, Ken, how many times is the book of Genesis quoted in the rest of the Bible?
Well, Genesis is quoted from or referred to in the rest of the Bible more than any other book of the Bible. In the New Testament alone, there are at least 200 quotations from or references to Genesis. In fact, there are over 100 citations or direct references in the New Testament to the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And every one of those 11 chapters is referred to somewhere in the New Testament. Not only that, but each New Testament author refers somewhere in his writings to Genesis, chapters 1 to 11 in particular. And Jesus Christ, the Creator, the Word, the Truth, quoted or referred to the first 11 chapters of Genesis on 6 different occasions. You see, if Genesis isn't true, then Jesus Christ was no more than a liar. Also, the rest of the Bible collapses, since every biblical doctrine of theology, directly or indirectly, is founded in the book of Genesis. That's why Genesis is referred to so often throughout the Bible. Believing the answers from Genesis is the key to fully understanding God's Word.
By reading the Bible's very first book, we also discover the answer to the question, why is there so much death and suffering in the world if there's a God? Ken Ham's timely booklet can be read right on your computer screen. It's free by simply going to AnswersRadio.com. Read the answer on your screen or print it out.
At AM 850 KFUO, the remaining time of Issues Etc. will be spent on the pilgrimage of Muslims to Iraq. Weather for St. Louis, overnight cloudy, occasional showers and thunderstorms in our forecast, low of about 52, and for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, with a continued chance for rain, high near 63. Right now, scattered clouds and 66 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic, northbound 270 between Dorset Road and 70, slow traffic in the right lanes. Westbound 44, slow in the right lane approaching 270. Westbound 40 before Compton, slow traffic to McKnight. Then heavy 270 to Mason. Eastbound 270 between McDonald Boulevard and 170, heavy traffic there. Northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane. And eastbound 40 after Grand Boulevard, heavy traffic to the Poplar Street Bridge.
AMA 50 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AMA 50 KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Last half hour of the program, we're going to spend talking about this amazing outpouring of grief, anger, and other emotions to the tune of 1 million people that we witnessed via satellite television from Karbala, Iraq. It's just one of the interesting elements of fallout after the liberation of Iraq. We're going to be talking about the Shiite pilgrimage, a seemingly spontaneous pilgrimage to Karbala. Why did all these Shiites show up there? What were they doing? And what does this demonstrate about the divisions, the basic divisions, in the Muslim religion? That's the subject for the last half hour of Issues Etc. Joining us here in just a moment, Dr. James Dredke, director of the Zwamer Institute of Muslim Studies. You can join us as well with questions or comments if you're curious about it. If you read about it in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or saw the same news I saw last night, some very dramatic stuff, not just the chanting and the yelling and the beating of oneself, but also men carrying long swords and cutting themselves and bleeding profusely. It does make one wonder. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. James Dredke is a regular guest here. Dr. James Dredke, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you.
Why are the Shiites making this pilgrimage to Karbala, Iraq, in the first place?
This particular occasion celebrates almost like a Lenten-like period of mourning for Hussein, who was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. He was the son of Ali, the fourth caliph. Caliph means successor to Muhammad, and in 680 AD, He was brutally killed by the political powers in that time. And his tomb was in Karbala. And this annual pilgrimage and even this annual period of mourning was totally suppressed and forbidden during Saddam Hussein's regime. And now they've had an opportunity for the first time in decades to do this pilgrimage.
Beyond the totalitarian nature of Saddam Hussein's regime, what other reasons might there have been of a religious nature for the Shiites' pilgrimage here to be banned under Saddam Hussein?
I think most scholars of Islam and scholars of Iraq would agree that Hussein, coming out of the Sunni minority, that's one part of it. Another part of it was the Ba'ath government was a secular government from the beginning and never wanted to give any voice to the Shiite majority, who is estimated to be about 50-60% of the population of Iraq.
Does the death and tomb of this ancestor of Muhammad, does his person play into the basic division between Sunni and Shiite Muslim?
Yes, to a certain extent. Actually, the picture is probably much bigger than that. The Shiites, Shia, it sort of means party, and if you put it in its full form, it's Shi'at Ali, the party of Ali. These were people who believed that Ali should have been the first successor to Muhammad. When Muhammad died suddenly, Ali didn't have a direct blood relationship, but he was married to Muhammad's daughter. And as a consequence, people felt that he should be the ruler. But he was passed over three times and finally became head of state and head of church, we might say. And then in the military coup d'etat, someone else took over power and was head of church and, or let's say, head of mosque and head of state. And it was, this all took place in 661 A.D. And then in 680, Ali's son, Hussein, tried to take over the government again and was brutally killed. And so when you see these people beating themselves, they are symbolically mourning the death of Hussein, who, as the Shia system emerged, they began to put a lot of authority in the hands of whoever was head of mosque and head of state, almost to the point where that authority is higher than that of the Quran, which is the substantive difference between the Sunnis and the Shia.
This raises several interesting questions. One of them has to do with the role of the clergy, if that's an accurate term here.
It's accurate.
In Islam, as opposed to the authority of the Quran, how do those two balance out?
Well, in the Sunni overall picture, the Quran is the highest authority, and even the clergy are to bow before that of the Quran. In the Shia system, if there is an appointed authority by God, which actually is the meaning of that word, Ayatollah. Ayat is used for a verse of the Quran or word of God. Ayat Allah divine word of God is the title given to the high-ranking clergy in the Shia. And as a consequence, Khomeini's voice, for example, was extremely powerful. It was like as if God was speaking to the people, sort of like when the Pope speaks ex cathedra from the papal cathedral, from the divine throne.
Now, how does that balance with the authority of the Quran? I assume here then that this is the clergy are a mediating authority between the average Muslim and his holy book? In other words, the authority devolves from the Quran to the clergy?
Well, in the Shia system, the authority almost comes direct from God to the clergy. But otherwise, yes, that is a somewhat of an accurate picture of Islam, that the highest authority is the Quran, and the priest mediates that to the people by way of the preaching on Fridays and other fatwas or legal declarations that might be issued.
And among the Sunnis, this other great branch of Islam, do the clergy hold similar authority?
No, they don't have such a powerful authority, although I think in a lot of places, just because the local people or the average person doesn't have much access to the Quran, since it's hidden away in the Arabic language, the clergy have a more powerful voice than they would otherwise have if you had everyone reading the Quran.
Now, this is something you've pointed out before in previous conversations on Islam, here on Issues, etc., and that is that the average Muslim, especially when you view it as an international world religion, does not have firsthand access to the Quran itself, even though he may have a copy of it. Explain that to us.
There's a very strong, persistent idea that the Quran is untranslatable. God gave it in Arabic. That's the language in which it's to be studied, researched, memorized, read. Something interesting happening on the American scene is that we now have quite a number of translations of the Quran into English. And, of course, there have been translations for some time into English, into French, and in German. But the Muslims will say that those are not the real word. The real word is only in the Arabic. And while many Muslims learn a few words of Arabic, to really learn and understand the language is a huge undertaking. And as a consequence, Muslims do not feast upon the Quran, sort of like Christians feast upon the Word of God, as God's Word direct to us in the words of the Bible.
So while they may have a copy of the Quran in Arabic, the language barrier for most of them still exists there?
It's still a very, very big barrier, right.
If they don't daily read it in the same sense of, as Christians reading and studying and understanding, does the average Muslim, is he familiar with what the Quran teaches?
Not really. In that many of them are very vulnerable to whatever their religious teachers are going to say and to preach.
Can you explain to us, and this may be cultural, although it seems to be intertwined with the religious element here too, can you explain to us the violent nature, or the apparently self-violent nature of the pilgrimage that we've been witnessing in Karbala, beating oneself, long, exhausting chants, people seem overwrought with various emotions, and then finally people cutting themselves with blades?
Yes. Well, that's a kind of a, to us, a very strange development. Related to showing great empathy for this man Hussein, who was killed by the political forces of that time, 680 A.D. And I suppose there's a somewhat of a vague similarity when we hear of Christians in some part of the world, like the Philippines is very noted for this, of men hanging on a cross during Good Friday in remembrance of Jesus' death. And these people are beating themselves in remembrance of Hussein's death.
The paper noted that they are not only mourning, but also vicariously punishing themselves for the failure of their ancestors to prevent Hussein's death, that
yes.
is, this grandson of Muhammad.
Yes, that's part of the picture, an important part of the picture.
We're talking with Dr. James Dredke. He's director of the Zwemer Institute for Muslim Studies. If you have a question or a comment on the pilgrimage made in Karbala, the 1 million man pilgrimage, or on Islam in general, give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. How significant is this pilgrimage? I know that it's probably going to be noted by the press as simply another odd occurrence after the liberation of Iraq, but to your eye, how significant is it?
I think something of great significance is that this is the first time that this majority of the people in Iraq have had a chance to express themselves. It opens the way for radical voices from Iran to try to interject themselves into what's happening in Iraq by calling for an Islamic State. And I often think of a phrase that was used politically in our own country for some time. Wasn't it President Nixon who talked about the silent majority? You see a lot of people out there very vocal, shouting for the creation of an Islamic State, and you wonder, what about the silent majority? Are they saying the same things, or do they sort of wish that those other radical voices would just go away?
Now, lest we paint with a broad brush here, Is it your understanding that the majority of Shiites, even in Iraq, I mean, these are people who have been repressed for a quarter of a century,
right.
But the majority of Shiites, not only in Iraq, but worldwide, are quote-unquote radical?
No, what I'm saying is that there's radical voices that are coming to the forefront, and you really don't know what the inner feelings and the voices of the majority of the people who are making the pilgrimage out of piety and a long-held desire to one day make that pilgrimage to Karbala, the site where one of the holiest shrines for the Shiites was, namely the burial place of Hussein.
You've mentioned this before when you were recounting the history for us, but you mentioned the successors to Muhammad being head of both church and state, that is, theological authority, secular or civil authority, all in one person. Does Islam, as a religion, recognize a distinction between church and state?
In theory, no. In theory, there's a longing for things to be like they were at the beginning, when Muhammad was the head of the religion and the head of the state. And that happened with each of his four successors, the last of whom was Ali, the father of this Hussein, whose martyrdom they're celebrating. And that still seems to be a deep down feeling in the Muslim heart that everything would be better if the head of state would be both head of the religion and head of the state.
When American Muslims look into the Islamic world and see Iran, a Muslim state where the Shiite majority exercises without a distinction between mosque and state this kind of total authority, other Muslim nations, when American Muslims look in there, do they long for this kind of thing? I mean, obviously they've had a taste of democracy, freedom, representative government, voting, things like that. Does that change things for them?
Well, I think our American Muslim neighbors are going through a lot of soul searching as they look at what's happening in other parts of the world and as they look at our own country here. I think a lot of the people who settled here from Iraq have a lot of hope that they might contribute to the rebuilding of Iraq along some of the principles of our own democratic society. But how much of a voice anyone from America can have in changing things in Iraq, that's has a big question mark over it.
Have you been surprised, as an observer of worldwide Islam, but also as an American observer, have you been surprised at the events, in particular those of a kind of a religious nature, that have been taking place in Iraq since the liberation?
No, not really. In fact, you wonder, once you break the ties of the power of a dictator like Saddam Hussein, and you give free rein to everyone in the society to express their own voice, whether that expression of those voices can be done in a peaceful way or whether it's just going to lead to chaos, those are one of the things that concern a lot of us.
Let's go to the phones with the few minutes that are left to us here in this conversation. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Miles is calling from his car. Thank you for waiting, Miles. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. My own theology does not admit to any kind of idea of a Christian theocracy, really, not at least formally, but I'm wondering how this country can export democracy to Iraq when we're not sure that our own idea is even going to allow Christianity to survive in our country the way things have worked out. And I'm wondering, hey, if things maybe weren't better under a dictator there, to keep all this stuff kind of really repressed. I'm wondering if repressing it was a bad idea and how we're actually going to help them without exporting Christianity. That's it.
Thank you, Miles. It's an interesting question. Dr. Dredke.
Miles, I wish I knew how to answer your question, because you're putting your finger on some of the more troubling aspects of this whole situation. And how a democracy can take shape, giving rights to the minorities within a sovereign state, this is something that I wonder how successfully it can happen in a nation like Iraq. Certainly a dictator is one who can keep everything under a strict control. It's much more difficult for a democratic situation in which every person has their own vote. And the tendency is, in the Islamic State, not to give many rights to the minorities.
One final question before we go, Dr. Dredke. I've asked this question of other experts on Islam. I'd like your take on this as well. Do Shiites and Sunnis, respectively, consider one another to be heretical, to be enemies, or do they stand together as Muslims?
Well, let me answer by way of two Muslims who heard me speak. They actually were in a worship service where they heard me preach a 45-minute sermon, and then they sat in for the Bible study, and I was not aware they were there. They came up, and they told me they had something very serious to disagree with me on, and I had talked about the crucifixion, how Islam denies that Jesus was crucified upon the cross, and other things. You know, in a few seconds, your mind just wanders what all they had that they were going to take exception to. And then they said, these were each PhD candidates at American universities, they said that I had said that 90% of the world's Muslims were Sunni, 10% were Shia, and they just wanted me to know that the Shia weren't even Muslims at all.
We have to end there and hopefully continue this conversation. I think there'll be much more to talk about. Dr. James Dredke, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're welcome.
Dr. James Dredke is director of the Zwemer Institute for Muslim Studies. You know, Miles asks an interesting question, and that is, you know, given the potential here between, just between Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq, for hatred, for bloodshed, for the reemergence of the same kind of theocracy, the same kind of Islamic Sharia law states that we find in Iran and other Muslim-held nations, would they be better off under a dictator where these things, at least the lid was kept on them? That is a tough question. I have to say, I think they're always better off with freedom. I know that the gospel is better off if it can be preached with free course under some kind of representative democracy, under some kind of freedom of religion. No solution is perfect here. But there is no doubt that what is unleashed, not just by liberating Iraq, but unleashed by the powerful mixture of two opposing religious views in Islam itself, has a great potential to shape the world. Now, I think we're better off with freedom. The question is, at what cost will that freedom be bought? That's the real question. Folks, for the next 3 days, it's going to be Share-a-thon 2003. I would like you to call in during the next 3 days at your leisure, at your convenience. The phone numbers that usually apply, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and support the gospel outreach of AM 850 KFUO. That's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, Share-a-thon 2003. You'll be hearing from me and the rest of the crew at AM 850 KFUO. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.